international bond finance. We are looking at the nature, origin, development, and structure and operation of the international bond market. We are contrasting this with the international loan syndicated lending market we call the euro loan market. We also have a parallel euro bond market. What we're doing is we're moving from bilateral direct lending created through personal obligations, which is the basis for the loan markets, the basis for the credit markets. We're now looking at capital markets where we embed the payment obligations in a transferable security. These instruments are then not just transferable, they're also negotiable, which means that you can acquire perfect title so long as you're purchasing them or you're receiving them without any notice of any prior defect in title. This is the additional advantage that the capital markets have. Instruments aren't just transferable, they're also negotiable, and because of that, it means that we create much more liquidity, which means very often you can borrow more at a cheaper cost in the capital markets. We're specifically going to focus on the international bond market, bond finance. We'll refer to the background to this in terms of the euro bond market. We'll also then move on and look at other shorter instruments as we move from the long bonds into medium-term notes down to shorter euro notes, as well as commercial paper, which can be up to 1 year. We also then have a series of other parallel domestic markets. These originate and operate at the domestic level, so we've also got sovereign bond and corporate bond at the domestic level. We can also have international bonds, or like foreign bonds, they're sometimes called, whereby we're borrowing from international markets, but in a country in the same currency, the local currency. That's not Eurobond, that's just a domestic foreign bond issue, as opposed to a Eurobond. The Eurobond markets emerged after the Second World War, following the restoration of currency convertibility in 1958. By this point, we had a very substantial growing euro loan market based on international dollars. The large surplus of dollar bills in America, these funds were transferred effectively to London. So London emerges as an international offshore centre for dollar debt in the post-war period. This begins the development of what we call the syndicated lending market. Because the largest companies in the world and governments in the world are borrowing, these amounts are enormous. It's not that a single bank cannot provide the funding, it's that the banks want to spread the risk in each case. So they will lend on a group, a club, or a syndicate basis. So if you want to, for example, borrow $100 million, typically you would approach 10 separate banks making up a syndicate, providing $10 million each. As I've already said, it's not that one bank can't afford the amount, they can afford the amounts, it's just that they want to spread the risk in practice. But what then happened, however, at a very early stage, we're going to develop a parallel bond market in addition to the loan market. So rather than borrow this $100 million through a 10-bank syndicated loan structure, we can issue the debt directly into the market over the 20 years. So we're raising the same amount of money, it's for the same duration, it's just that we're going to do it in the form of a security, a negotiable instrument. The advantage of that is that because of the additional liquidity in the markets, we can usually borrow more at a finer coupon rate, that's the interest rate that you pay on the bond, in the capital markets than you would in the banking markets. The principal alternative then to bank lending is through debt securities and specifically bonds. The bond market is one of the largest markets in the world. It's estimated to be worth around, for example, $140 trillion at this time. I've provided separate tables on the system which explain how all of this fits into the larger international financial system. What we're then looking at is this. The principal advantage is that these instruments are inherently transferable and negotiable, but we can also then sell them, we can deal with them either on formal markets or on an over-the-counter basis. Much of the Eurobond trading will be over-the-counter. One of the key issues that arises, however, is that these bonds themselves are immobilized in practice. There are two primary custodians in the bond market, that's Euroclear and Clearstream. Euroclear is based in Brussels, Clearstream is based in Luxembourg. What tends to happen is all of the bonds that we're issuing are immediately deposited with Euroclear and Clearstream. All of the secondary trading in these markets then occurs over the accounts held by the major banks and financial institutions in the world. They will have accounts with both Euroclear and Clearstream, and there is also a fiber optic bridge between them, so you can transfer assets between them as well. A lot of the market then, it can be on a formal stock market and exchange, but in practice a lot of this is over the counter. The government bond market is a specifically, particularly large sector of this. Why is that? Because companies can issue both shares and bonds, but governments can only issue bonds. Because the governments can't issue shares in themselves, they're even more dependent on the bond market. That's why the sovereign bond market is particularly large. So what will basically happen is all of the major governments in the world, virtually all governments, and all of the largest companies in the world, how do they fund themselves? They fund themselves through bond activity. What's the difference between a bond and a share? Essentially, with a share, you own a proportionate interest in the company valued on a going concern, whereas if you're a bondholder, you're only holding a debt obligation issued by the company. The company's only making a promise to pay you. Shareholders and bondholders both have payment rights. A shareholder receives a dividend, a bondholder receives interest, as well as information rights and voting rights. The voting rights of the shareholders, however, are much stronger, much more powerful than the bondholders, which will be very limited in practice. Bond documentation tends to be shorter and simpler. However, because there's more parties in the market, there tends to be more documents. So we need to understand how all of this works. The history of the market has then been one of shorter duration. So we can transfer a large fixed amount borrowing from the syndicated lending market, for example, 20-year syndicated loan, into the bond market, 20 years. The subsequent history has then been one of shorter durations. So we go from long 20-year bonds down to medium-term notes, down 15, 10, 5, down to shorter euro notes, 1, 2, 3, then down to less than 1 year. Generally, if it's less than 1 year, we call it commercial paper, although we can also have euro notes less than 1 year. The difference between a euro note and commercial paper is that the euro note will be committed, it will be underwritten, it will be for a larger denomination, typically $500,000 rather than $100,000, and the program can be triggered within commercial paper a day, euro note possibly 7 days. It's more formal, it's more structured. It can have the same economic advantages, it just takes longer to process from a legal and management and administrative perspective. One of the significant elements of the bond market is that we have a large number of different types of bonds and notes. The legal difference is that if it's fixed interest, it's a bond, so we can have short bonds if they're fixed. A note is floating rate, so we can have long notes and we can have short bonds. The technical difference is one of the attached payment obligation. If it's fixed, it's bond. If it's a note, it's floating. However, what tends to happen in practice, longer instruments we tend to call bonds instinctively, and then shorter instruments we tend to call notes. And then, as I've said already, under 1 year commercial paper, although we can also have short euro notes. There are then a large number of different types of possible options within the markets. So, for example, we talk about step down, step ups, margins, floating then fixed, fixed then floating. We talk about zero coupons. We talk about floor, drop locks, double drop locks, caps, collars, inverse collars. The reason for this is that when we're actually setting up a capital market instrument, a lot of the options we build in at the design stage up front, we don't have the same flexibility that we have under the loan structure, so we actually have to incorporate this, which becomes structural features within the instrument itself. That's why we have so many different options. We will take a decision how long we're going to issue this for, what the rights are, what the currency is, what the interest attachments are. All of that's effectively locked in up front. We don't have the same flexibility and continuous capacity to adjust that we do with a loan. So we have to pre-design, which means that there's a large number of additional options and varieties available when we look at the market structure and operation of all of the possible options which can be available. In terms of historical development, bond markets go back to the earliest. Basically, we can go way back into Babylonian times, into ancient Sumeria, Akkadia, these great civilizations. We had bonds and debt instruments back then. In terms of the modern markets, a lot of this begins with the instruments used by the early city-states in North Italy. So, for example, in Florence, we had the Monte Comune, and then something very similar again in Venice from the 1300s onwards. Much of this was basically tied to tax income. So what the early city-states, which would later become countries effectively after they consolidate and would come together, the cities needed funds, so they would borrow against future tax income, tax receipts, so they could enter into these long annuity types instruments and then very often had them operating on a perpetual basis. How were they repaid? They were repaid from the income stream as the city grew and as trade expanded following the end of the Reformation and the beginning of the Renaissance period. We will see a lot of these earlier instruments then transfer into Amsterdam and then later into London. We've also got the beginning of new forms of companies. So we see that particularly with the Dutch East India Company beginning in 1609 and a number of other options across Europe. Technically, however, the first company was actually the Aberdeen Harbour Authority in Scotland in 1136, granted by King David of Scotland under royal title. In London, these bonds grow and become very important during the 16 and 1700s, especially with early annuities in the form of perpetual and redeemable bonds with a 3% annuities in 1726 and then 3% consols from 1751 onwards. I then explained the rest of the subsequent development of the markets. The core innovation is then, as we've mentioned already, the growth of the euro-dollar system after the Second World War. London will re-emerge as the most important international financial centre, even though the dollar bill, the dollar currency, becomes the most important currency after the Second World War. London will still reacquire its centre position as the international financial centre of the world, mainly through this emerging euro loan and euro dollar market. I then expand and explain the rest of the growth and development of the market in the text. Technically, the first euro bond was the Otto Strade deal. That was S.G. Warburg, 1963, and I've provided copies of some of the certificates and early documentation that was involved with that on the system. Bond structures. As with other types of financial instruments, we can consider this in terms of the amount. So we need the amount, we need the term, we need the interest, we need drawdown, and then repayment. All of that has to be built into the documentation, and we will design that and then lock that into these capital market instruments, as we've explained. I go through all of the different options in further detail with regards to each of those in the paper. In terms of procedural issues and setting these transactions up, I explain this again. It's very similar to a typical loan type deal in the international euro loan markets. It's just that there's some additional documents that we have to consider, so we'll build that in. In the paper, I look at this in terms of acquiring the mandate. We have the launch date, drafting documentation, we agree the terms, the core financial terms, we have a signing in particular for the subscription agreement, we'll then have dealing and stabilisation, a grey market will emerge from the first notification to the market that these bonds are coming, very often 2 weeks after the initial approach and 2 weeks before the closing and the final allotments. This allows the lead managers to adjust the price. This would otherwise constitute a form of illegal unauthorized market manipulation, but it's permitted in certain circumstances to protect the price so we have a safe, stable issue subsequently. We'll then have pre-allotments and then formal allotments. This is also tied to the size and nature of this grey market and the pricing which happens during this period. If it's a large public issue, we'll have a trust deed. A trustee is appointed to act on behalf of the bondholders collectively, so this becomes a very important document. It won't be signed during the early stages. When the subscription agreement is signed, very often it'll be signed on the final closing date, but it has to be prepared and negotiated. We'll also have listing, so we need to prepare for listing. We can have admission to listing and admission to trading. On the euro dollar market, if this is simply a bought deal, whereby the lead bank, the arranging bank, will acquire the bonds and undertake to sell them on through the market, through its own selling arrangements, selling relationships, selling structures, selling networks, we don't need to consider any form of larger public issue. On larger bond amounts, we may want to have a full public offer, in which case we need to consider admission to listing. Many countries, most countries, maintain some form of listing authority and listing system, whereby we have to get pre-approval to bring the instrument to the market so we can make a public offer. We call that admission to listing. This was initially carried out by the London Stock Exchange in the United Kingdom following the Big Bang, when the London Stock Exchange demutualized itself in 1986. It basically abolished fixed commissions, it allowed foreign ownership, and it abandoned the earlier dual structure, which divided the participants in the market between stock jobbers and stock brokers, one acting for the clients and one acting for themselves. Following this Big Bang, it was decided that the London Stock Exchange should no longer continue to act as the listing authority, because it effectively created almost a conflict of interest. It was going to demutualize, turn itself into a public limited company, and then register on its own markets that it was managing. So responsibility for listing was then transferred to the Financial Services Authority, the FSA, which becomes the Financial Conduct Authority after the Financial Services Act 2012. So we have admission to listing, where we get pre-approval of documentation, where we're going to make a public offering. We also have separate admission to trading, where we get the documents separately approved if we want to register the securities, the bonds, on a particular stock market and exchange. In the euro dollar deal, most bonds, where they are to be registered and listed, will be listed in London or Luxembourg. So we need to prepare for listing as well. We'll then have the closing. At the closing, the lead manager will make available the full amount of funds expected, which will be paid over to the issuer by electronic funds transfer. In return for that, the company will issue a temporary global bond. Temporary global bond is a sui generis instrument which represents all the subsequent bonds that are to follow, the definitive bonds. In practice, it can take up to 40 days. It'll take a number of weeks to print the definitive bonds, so we have to have some delay. From a legal perspective, this is actually required under American law, under what's called the TEFRA, so that we can have a suitable period of time which allows the law firms involved and the issuer to confirm that the bonds are not being sold to American citizens unless they're being sold under one of the available exemptions under the Securities Act 1933 or Securities and Exchange Act 1934. TEFRA is the Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act 1982 that creates what we call a 40-day lockdown. So we can't buy and sell the bonds for 40 days until we've confirmed that no American citizen have purchased these unless under one of the relevant exemptions which are available. So the definitive notes will not be produced, brought onto the market for 40 days afterwards. At that time, in practice, what usually then happens is that they're immediately deposited with the two custodians, Euroclear and Clearstream. They are effectively immobilized in the euro dollar market. If it's a corporate bond market, they may go to other custodians or sub-custodians around the world, or they may be received by the investors directly. But euro bonds will generally always be held with Euroclear and Clearstream. In terms of modern practice, it's now much more common to actually dematerialise, which means we can actually create the bonds and issue the bonds without actually having a certificate. In those cases, again, however, we will still effectively electronically deliver them to Euroclear and Clearstream, so all of the secondary trading then occurs across their accounts, as with the immobilised instruments. So we deal with all of this procedure and all of the issues involved in the chapter. The core issue that then arises is with regards to negotiability, as we've explained. I go through all of the core case law in this area. There's a number of important leading cases which explain the nature of negotiability and all the different issues which arise, all of which I cover in some detail there. The key point about negotiability is it's determined by the market. It's a matter of market practice, and there's famous cases in this area: Picker versus London and Country Banking, Buchanan Land Exploration, Edelstein versus Schuller, Edelstein versus Schumer, Bingham 155. In my opinion, the time has passed when the negotiability of bearer bonds, whether government bonds or trading bonds, foreign or English, can be called in question in our courts. It's not for the courts to determine. The existence of their usage has been so often proved, and its convenience is so obvious, that it must be taken now to be part of the law. It's a matter of market practice. What had occurred and happened in some of these case law cases, for example, Prussian bonds were regarded as negotiable in Prussia, but not in London. And because of looking at the London markets, they therefore were not considered to be negotiable instruments in the international bond markets. The core test is one of volume and frequency rather than duration, and I discuss and explain this in further detail. I also spend time looking at the governing law and public international law aspects of this. I note and provide the background to the issues which have arisen with regards to bond clearing again, in particular with the use of Euroclear and Clearstream. Very often what might happen is, even if we don't intend it to have the bond traded on a formal stock market and exchange, we may still want to have it admitted to get permission for it to be listed. The reason for that is that it then changes the classification category of the instrument from a risk perspective. So very often large insurance companies, investment companies, life companies, unit trusts, even hedge funds, they want to purchase these instruments, although they're only entitled to purchase a certain amount above a certain risk class or below a certain risk class. If these are listed, you can very often sell them openly and freely. So even if you don't intend to actually deal with them in a formal stock market and exchange, you may still want to have them listed, because it allows other instruments, institutional investors, to then purchase them, which means the market increases, the market grows, so the liquidity is also higher, which means you can get a finer coupon rate and you can borrow more at lower cost. In terms of bond structures, we then have the Eurobonds. There's all sorts of different types of variations and instruments, which I explain here. We mentioned this before. This is tied to the fact that we have all of these different types of design options that we need to consider, that we will then build into the structure of the offering up front. So we have, for example, just on Eurobonds. So we can have plain vanilla or variable bonds. We can have zero coupon bonds, foreign currency bonds, reverse dual currency bonds, first coupon or partly paid bonds, currency change bonds, annuity bonds. And I explain the nature of each of all of these in the text. One of the interesting points is with regards to zero coupon bonds. When we're issuing the bonds, we can either sell them at par, which is face value, at a premium, which is higher than the face value, or at a discount, depending upon how the market expects, or the issuer or the advising lead bank expects the bonds to be received. They may want to attach a premium to them. But what you're simply going to do in practice is this: you will adjust the premium, par or discount with the coupon. So depending upon which way you adjust these, you can move the coupon appropriately as well to make sure that you have a safe, stable market in the instruments subsequently. We also specifically have what we call deep discount bonds. In deep discount situations, you're going to have a very large discount on the price. It might be 10%, it could even be 20%, possibly 25%. The reason for that is what you're effectively doing is this: you are rolling up the interest into the price of the bond, and then deducting that from the face value so that the investor is purchasing the bond at, for example, 70% face value. What that effectively means is you're then rolling up the interest over the next 20 years into the price of the bond. So after 20 years, the investor presents the bond and receives the full face value. The reason for that is tax, because that then means that the investor does not have to pay tax for the next 10 years, 20 years. It doesn't have to pay tax on the incomes received. It can manage it at the end. It's all dependent upon the investment strategy of the investor class that's purchasing this particular bonds. So very often, if you're intending this to be targeted to a specific group of investors who are more interested in longer-term investments rather than short-term returns, you'll use deep discount bonds. The history of the market, then, as we've explained already, was one of shorter duration instruments. However, this also occurred at the same time as we had the collapse of the Bretton Woods system at the beginning of the 1930s. The formal exchange rate mechanism that was established under the Bretton Woods treaty system, which was agreed in July 1944, was that we would fix the value of the dollar to gold at $35 per ounce, and then the value of all other currencies are fixed to the dollar, subject to a tied but adjustable exchange rate mechanism. This collapses at the beginning of the 1970s. President Richard Nixon announces the closure of the gold window on 15th August 1971 in a radio address on the State of the Union. Through the costs of the Vietnam War, as well as other pressure on the American economy, the fact that the American governments always want to increase spending but not increase taxation because it doesn't garner votes, there was a lot of pressure on the Treasury at that time. There had been a large withdrawal of gold from the United States because effectively under the Bretton Woods system, the American government was legally obliged to exchange gold bullion for dollar bills. The Americans decided they wanted to halt this for a temporary period and then a permanent period. This led to what was called the closure of the gold window. This means that we then move on to floating currencies. A committee of 20 tried to arrange an alternative system for international currency arrangements during 1972-73. That failed, so we moved formally on to floating currencies around end of 73-74. This is then formally recognised by the IMF at a Jamaica meeting in 1976, which leads to formal amendments being made to the IMF treaties. The key response to this from a market perspective is that we're then going to shift from long fixed rate bonds to floating rate notes. So the FRNs really grow and expand at the beginning of the 1970s, and I explain the background to this in the chapter. I've also provided on the system a separate historical chapter and a market chapter. The origins and the first deals in all of these areas is dealt with in the historical chapter, so you can actually see the first of all of these offer rings, which I spent some time researching. Again, however, even with the floating rate notes, we're going to have a large number of different options. Because the structure, operation, and rights attached to the instruments are tied into the instrument on issuance, we have lots of different options because it's locked and we can't change the entitlements afterwards. So we have floor FRNs, drop lock FRNs, double drop locks, caps, collars, inverses, step down, step ups, margins, floating rates, fixed then floating, variables, zero coupons and rolling rates. We've also got bunny bonds or bunny notes, we've got lobos and bolos, graduated rate bonds, deferred coupon bonds, profit sharing, indexed and duets. All of these different types of options were designed and developed to try and attract particular investors at particular times with a specific set of rights and entitlements. Again, we can still have perpetual bonds. These were used quite commonly from a government perspective, a sovereign perspective, a large number of hundreds of years ago. They became much less important, but they are still available. So we can have perpetual bonds, we can have options and convertibles and extendables. These will all be subject to some cancellation tool. There will be a trigger that you can, if in the event, for example, of default, mean that you can convert them into a repayable instrument which the issuer can discharge. But otherwise, unless that trigger applies, these can last indefinitely. They can be very attractive in the market, depending upon the rate that's attached, that's applied to them. We've also got warrants. Warrants are an entitlement to buy more of the same thing at usually a specified price within a specified option availability period. So you're effectively buying a double bond. You buy the bond and an entitlement to purchase more of them at a future time, depending upon the performance of the bond itself. But again, however, there's a large number of options we can tie to this, so therefore we can design this into the structure and nature of the particular instruments that we are making available to the markets. So we have putables and redeemables, we have naked warrants, covered warrants, option warrants, commodity warrants. All of these I explain in the chapter. Again, we can tie the bonds and the payments on them to equity, to stock markets, to other entitlements, which lead to equity-linked bonds. What then happened was this: in terms of development, we had the FRNs emerging in the early 1970s. This then leads to the creation of what we call the NIFs, the NIFs, note issuance facilities. As we become shorter and shorter, we're going to need to issue more and roll over more quickly in the market. This is a form of what we call dematerialization. What's going to happen is that instead of having to bring the lead bank back in, the investment bank, having to come back each time we want to issue another 1 year, 2 year, 3 year note package, what we do is we set this up in the form of a program or a facility so that the companies, the issuer themselves, can manage this. So the company will decide, I want to issue another 3 year program or another 6 month program or whatever. It can then do it itself. So we have NIFs became very important during the 70s and the beginning of the 80s, note issuance facilities, which would support these shorter rate instruments. In terms of the actual duration, what actually happened was we go from the long bonds transferring over to the long notes, fixed to floating, and then we became very short. So we came right down to euro notes, short euro notes, possibly over a year, possibly less than a year, and then we go back up to medium-term notes. 15, 10-year, 5-year notes. The historical reason for this was simply because we import into London the domestic American practices on their MTN market, which had evolved in the United States. So we go from long notes, FRNs and NIFs, down to very short instruments supported by the NIF, and then go back up to the medium-term notes. You'll simply see that in terms of the specific deals and the dates of the first instruments and issuance for each. And again, I spent some time on this and I've tried to explain all of that in the historical chapter, which is made available. With MTNs, again, there's a large number of options. So we can have Euro MTNs, we can have global MTNs, we can have colts continuously offered, we can have coins continuously offered, intermediate notes as opposed to long-term notes, and then we can have TTNs, multi-tranche tap notes. And then we're into the short Euro notes. As I've said, historically, we went from long notes to very short euro notes and then back up to MTNs, although in the chapter, it just looked better to have the MTNs before the euro notes. The euro notes can be over 1 year or they can be less than 1 year. The difference, as we've said already, is that they will be for larger durations, they'll be underwritten and they'll take longer periods of time to bring to the market, up to 7 days rather than 1 day with commercial paper. Again, however, there's a large number of options. Dual and multiple placing agency notes, dealership placements. These are just different types of structured offerings to make them available, to bring them into the market. Then the notes themselves, we can have short-term note issuance facility, a NIF or a SNIF, a securities note commitment facility, SNCF. We can also have a revolving acceptance facility by tender, a RAFT, and then a global note facility. This then takes us into commercial paper, which is the slightly less formal debt instruments, essentially still promissory notes that issuers can bring to the markets, anything up to 1 year. If it's up to 1 year, it's commercial paper, if the issuers are bringing it directly themselves. The key point here is that these are still promissory notes. All of these instruments legally are promissory notes under Section 83 of the Bills of Exchange Act 1882. I've tried to summarise these on the separate tables I've provided with regards to the structure and operation of the market and then the issuance timelines. These are effectively short-dated, bearer, unsecured, negotiable, tax-free, listed or unlisted, committed and uncommitted, which means underwritten or non-underwritten, promissory notes. Commercial paper itself then grows and emerges very substantially. So we have European commercial paper, we have sterling commercial paper, we can have other currency commercial paper. One of the difficulties which arose and hindered this market was the fact that if a company is issuing commercial paper into the market and receiving funds in return for that, it's almost the same as a deposit. So it almost becomes like a bank. So we had to create exemption and exclusions to prevent that from constituting banking business. So sterling commercial paper does not emerge until 1986. And what you'll then see in the chapter is we're going to develop guidelines by the British Bankers Association, the BBA guidelines on commercial paper. This market, however, once it's established, will grow and develop very substantially. I've also simply included here certificates of deposits. Again, strictly speaking, these are money market instruments, although they're very similar to the types of short-dated notes that we're looking at here. A certificate deposit is simply a statement that confirms that a large amount has been deposited with a bank for a fixed period, and therefore, because of that, we issue it in the form of a money market instrument, which can be bought and sold the same as a security. On top of that, we then have MOFs. So we have multi-option facilities. These are a range of options which we can then build into a specific particular type of instrument, whereby we provide a lot of these different options together. So short-term advance, swing line facility, commercial paper, banker's acceptance, and Euro commercial note program. So we actually combine banking and securities together, capital markets with credit instruments, as well as provide maximum possible option. The use of the swing line facility as well allows us to borrow short when we're transferring between instruments. The rest of the chapter then just looks at the domestic bond markets and explains all the different types. So from a UK perspective, from a US perspective, Germany, Japan, all of these I explain. Corporate bond markets, other options, other variations. The chapter just reviews all of the different other possible options which can arise in the markets. And with all of this, we can understand the nature and importance of the modern bond market. This is still of absolutely crucial importance in terms of international borrowing. Governments and the largest companies in the world are completely dependent on these markets. They're of essential importance, and we need to protect their long-term health and stability.